Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Eastern European Studies. My name is Jelena Golubovic, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Mila Dragojevic about her new book, Amoral Communities, Collective Crimes in Time of War. This is published this year, so 2019, by Cornell University Press. So this book is a study of how violence against civilians becomes not only thinkable, but permissible during wartime. The central focus on the book is on Croatia in the 1990s, but she also brings in Guatemala and Uganda as comparative case studies. So Mila, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, Jelena, thank you for having me, and thank you for the interest in the book.
Oh, of course. So the central questions that this book seeks to answer are: why are civilians targeted in war in instances where there's no clear military or strategic advantage to targeting them? And two, why do some communities experience violence and others do not over the course of the same war? So to get us started, for listeners that may be unfamiliar with the former Yugoslavia or Croatia, can you tell us what it was about the case of Croatia that compelled you to seek answers to these questions and to write this book?
Yes. So the case of Croatia is particularly interesting because of both methodological and theoretical reasons for the study of violence against civilians in war times. Let me begin with a methodological reason. For those who may not be as familiar, during the war in the 90s, there were some multi-ethnic regions of Croatia with higher levels of violence against civilians, specifically eastern and western Slavonia, central Croatia, northern Dalmatia. And then there were other multi-ethnic regions like Gorski Kotar and Podravina in northwestern part of Croatia that did not experience such high levels of violence against civilians. And so there was this subnational variation in the levels of what I call targeted violence against civilians across different multi-ethnic communities, which leads us to then ask a question: why some regions experienced this and the others did not. So it is a good kind of subnational comparison. And then the second reason is theoretical, because of the literature, especially in the field of political science, that emphasized, there is now growing literature that emphasizes other uses of violence, but there is substantial literature that emphasized military strategy as the main strategy for the use of violence in wars and in the ways that violence against civilians can be explained. But if you look at the case of Croatia on closer examination, we see that even though there may be some military strategic reasons, particularly in the regions of eastern Slavonia, which are closer to Serbia, there are also patterns that make us also ask a question: but why did then, for example, Serb forces, after occupying certain parts of eastern Slavonia, commit atrocities against civilians? So after the disputed territory had already been conquered, there would be no military motivation or reason to to attack civilians. And that happened, for example, in Ovčara, in near Vukovar, and Lovas, and many other cases that I discuss in Eastern Slavonia, the village of Čelije, in central Croatia, Sisak, Glina, Bačin, Joševica, and so on, in northern Dalmatia, Široka Kula, Gospić, Škabrnja, and other regions. So these are the explanations that I was seeking, trying to understand, you know, first of all, from methodological reasons, why some regions experienced greater levels of violence, and then why did violence happen after the territory was already occupied by the perpetrators. So does that answer sufficiently the question? Or? Yeah.
Great. So one of the main contributions from this book is that you're developing a concept of amoral communities. And you explain that these are created through the culmination of three elements. So you talk about the ethnicization of everyday life, the exclusion of moderates, and the production of borders. And we'll go into each of these elements in turn. But for the beginning, can you just describe what you mean by amoral communities?
The term is referring to a context in which the perpetrators believe that that their actions of violence are not going to be penalized, and that they are in this context acceptable. And this only this context, I should emphasize, develops only in some regions, not uniformly, as I already mentioned. And instead of punishing the perpetrators of criminal acts, so that you know, civilians and prisoners of war would be protected or feeling protected under any circumstances, the leaders in power place more emphasis in this context on resolving a political crisis, winning a war, eliminating those defined as enemies. In this context, again, violence against civilians is not only tolerated, but may be actually covered up, presented as random accidents, necessary sacrifice, given the urgent need to respond to a security crisis. Another characteristic is that this is a context where violence is used, what I refer to as violence, the use of violence as a political strategy. And I distinguish it from the use of violence as a military strategy. And it's characterized by targeting of individuals who are excluded from the envisioned nation state or a nation body. I use this term in a book on the basis of identity. And the identity, as the way I use it, I call it political ethnicity. A term that describes the attempt to connect both political and cultural identity. This concept of amoral communities in this way builds on the concept of Benedict Anderson's imagined communities. And it also explains why in the cases of violence against civilians, context develops, it is not necessary to send the armies, but the local population that remains in these areas becomes involved either as victims or perpetrators. So that would be in short, or maybe a long answer, to explain this concept.
There is a nice element of it I liked as well in the book about, you talk about people's freedom to intervene or to do something that would challenge the situation, and how in an amoral community, people don't have the freedom to act according to their own beliefs and how they feel like life should be conducted.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And exactly, that is exactly the, the context in this particular time and space when people lose that basic freedom to act or to express their personal views that do not correspond to those dominant views that seem to be imposed on them by the political leaders or by the situation. So that is essential, the loss of freedom of movement and freedom of expressing views of one's own that do not align with dominant views.
Yeah, and you just mentioned as well in the previous answer the term political ethnicities. So moving into the ethnicization of everyday life, which is sort of one of the elements through which these amoral communities are created, I'd love if you could just talk a bit more about this concept and explain how it took hold in Croatia and how people became divided into political ethnicities in the war.
As I mentioned, this term is it's not a new term. It's a term that builds on many other studies, but it really is important in this context because it shows how a cultural identity, in this case ethnicity, becomes linked or fused with political identity. And there is that contributes then to the polarization and division along political ethnicities or these new identities that emerged. How does it begin? And I emphasize this in a book. It actually starts usually from the top, in the discourse of political leaders, in the media, in the new policies and decrees of the government. So as we are looking for later, when I discuss in the book ways to prevent, which isn't the focus of the book, but hopefully there will be some signs in the book about how we can learn something from this and prevent. Those are the first things that we may want to pay attention to as we are concerned about preventing such crimes from happening. And then over the course of this process of discourse from the top or in the media, statehood becomes redefined in terms of political inclusion of certain political ethnicities and the exclusion of others. And it doesn't necessarily take hold, this process of what I call ethnicization or creation of political ethnicities uniformly on a national level. But in some regions, it might take hold. And then that happens following certain incidents of violence for example, in my interviews, one respondent mentioned that inter-ethnic divisions were evident only after some of the respondents' co-workers started missing from work right before what was in Croatia, Log Revolution, and after violent incidents in the Plitvice region in March, on March 31st, 91. So that specific point of violence was essential. And what happened is this respondent described how people assumed that those who were missing from work joined insurgency, and then automatically they were seen as taking the other side. And this is how these first divisions and distrust started to develop, and why these initial incidents of violence were critical for that to happen in some parts of Croatia and central Croatia. So after these kind of incidents, separations into distinct groups coincided with the start of violence, and the people who once were friends then became either Serbs or Croats following this escalation of violence. So that is one first step, but also the divisions, the physical divisions, the setup of barricades and roadblocks, then that these divisions divide people into us and them, and not only physically but socially, then distrust can grow. And as I described, these are some of the processes that may lead to further polarization in these communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where just being a certain ethnicity is tied to having political views. Like, this person is a Serb or a Croat, therefore they must be on the other side.
Exactly.
So concerning the other two, so the ethnicization of everyday life, the way you put it is this is like a necessary condition, or this is sort of the backdrop. But then the two main mechanisms, I guess, by which amoral communities are formed are the exclusion of moderates and the production of borders, which you just mentioned through establishments of checkpoints and so on. And what I really enjoyed in your book was that as you're describing these two mechanisms, you really pay attention to the emotions that accompany them. And so, for example, how fear comes into play and is associated with threats and rumors and suspicion and so on. And this will probably be a long answer, and I should have divided it maybe into two questions, one for each mechanism. But could you just speak in turn about the exclusion of moderates and the production of borders and how these contribute to the formation of amoral communities, and perhaps also maybe centering the role of emotion in these processes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are the most essential processes, and of course a very important question to pose. So in some areas or regions, moderates or those individuals who challenged these ethnicization processes were excluded. And they were excluded through the use of either targeted small-scale violence, so they would be either threatened or maybe even injured, or in some cases even killed. And that would serve as kind of a warning to others who might want to challenge the newly posed order and political views. There would be also some more subtler forms of social ostracism that would lead people to kind of keep quiet and not express fully their views, their personal views. But let me begin maybe with an example from the region that did not experience extensive violence against civilians, or more specifically Gorski Kotar in northwestern Croatia, where moderates were actually not excluded through these threats or harassment or use of fear or even outright violence. There, individuals, activists, and local community members, like in case of Franjo Starčević, traveled across barricades in the summer of 91 to neighboring villages and promoted the idea of nonviolence, negotiating between the leaders of conflicting sides, keeping these lines of communication open so there wouldn't be growing distrust among local population. In contrast, in other regions where moderates were not excluded, where moderates were excluded, such as in eastern Slavonia, Osijek police chief Josip Rajhel Kir attempted to do the same. He tried to travel and talk to different sides and try to remove the barricades and facilitate negotiations, but he was killed already in the summer of 91. So even before the war started, in some multi-ethnic communities, there were these instances of both attempts to negotiate and build bridges, but also instances of threats and violence and growing fear and distrust. So in those areas where again, we see more escalation, we see that the power of those who wanted to establish communication was weakened by the violence, and those who wanted to impose a more a new division between the population started to gain more prominence through the use of fear and threat and so on. And I would say that additionally, the creation of these new borders, of these new checkpoints and barricades, forced individuals to choose one or only two political options that coincided with their ethnicity. And the population in those communities then was both divided and then policed more easily because of the kind of cultural markers that were attached to them after the divisions occurred. And because the line of communication between local population was broken, then it became more easily to spread rumors and to have that distrust and fear grew stronger. So then that led to more incentive to create new barricades and new barriers between the population. So in some villages, there were what some of my respondents referred to as double barricades from inside and outside. So people really could not move freely. And the general atmosphere of distrust and unrest increased this sense of fear and insecurity in these particular regions. And then you saw that is accompanied with more violence. And I would like to also bring in here examples of Uganda and Guatemala, which had striking similarities to Croatia in this regard, because in Uganda, disappearances early on contributed to general sense of fear and distrust. And one of my respondents said, your very brother could betray you. We were told not to trust even your very shadow. And so that gives you the example of how that is a universal feeling that once people are separated like this, and then there are these incidents and then rumors, how that creates this atmosphere of distrust. Also in Guatemala, well-known civil patrols were put in place, and they were their main role was what I refer to later in a book as in-group policing, or basically keeping their own groups in check, making sure that there are no individuals who will step out of the expected line and act on their own in line with their own personal views. So people were so afraid to refuse to follow what they were told that they continued to take part in this in-group policing processes in this particular communities. Only in rare cases, in case of Guatemala, I had in some cases of interviews, examples of people who were able to stay outside in a sort of neutral way outside of the conflict. And it was because in this case, a person was not really a member of the community, but was able to freely travel in the region and had a freedom of exit from the particular region that was blocked off by roadblocks from the rest of the country. So once we have these processes, and that happen sometimes, actually most of the time simultaneously, the exclusion of moderates and the production of border take place, then these new identities or political ethnicities become more salient, more visible, and they become a shortcut of politically categorizing individuals into, the friends and enemies. And it's much more convenient for those who want to police or control population to have them divided in this way. So I think that's my long answer to this question. Yeah.
The examples of Guatemala and Uganda were really...
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Striking, because it just really shows you how these patterns are consistent in other cases and how these factors in different contexts really lead to the same result, which is unnecessary violence against civilians. And there was something that, you can tell me if I understood this right, but I mean, when you have it laid out here as sort of like a pattern that creates immoral communities, what was a bit counterintuitive was that from the interviews, it seems like some people who were inside the communities, so they're inside these spaces where they can't move freely and there's borders and checkpoints, those borders and checkpoints actually give them a feeling of security precisely because the other side is constructed as a threat to them. So even though they're actually more at risk because of these borders and checkpoints, it gives them a feeling of safety. Did I catch that right?
Yes,
in the book?
And that is the paradox of this situation, is that actually the initial barriers lead to more and more desire for barriers that would divide because of the security concern, because of growing distrust. You want more protection and more barricades. So it's a very dangerous situation, because that's what leads to more and more escalation and more potential for this kind of atrocities to take place, because the outcome is not what people desire when they want to be protected. The outcome is that they feel more exposed and vulnerable because they're blocked off, actually, and they have no freedom of movement. No. So it's a very that was what was interesting in this study, to encounter this, and why I thought it was important to highlight it.
And you had just mentioned as well in the last question, places where violence didn't take place and crimes didn't occur. And I think that's a really great and interesting part of your book, is that you don't just focus on, you know, the sensational, the violent, those sorts of episodes. You also, because you want to understand how this can be prevented, so you also look at places where violence didn't take place. So I wanted to ask you, what were the most important distinguishing factors between those cases, and what sort of takeaways are there for how the descent into amoral communities can be prevented?
Mm-hmm. So I would say that there were many more cases of certain solidarity or help that people provided to one another. And if you look at, first of all, in the communities that didn't experience such high levels of violence, that was the case. But also even in the areas that had more violence, some of my respondents mentioned, almost everyone mentioned a story of some type of solidarity. And that is actually what gives us hope that, yes, this can be prevented and there are certain things that can be done. So what was puzzling to me was that given the solidarity and even connections that were extensive in the case of Croatia across ethnic lines, how is it possible that violence was not prevented everywhere, actually? I would have expected that to happen based on the kind of connections that already existed prior to war. It was only successfully prevented in some communities, and I don't believe it is because there was some kind of a better connection or better people. It is simply because in those regions, the individuals who wanted to prevent were not disempowered. In the regions where violence was more extensive, those individuals who wanted to prevent were disempowered. They didn't have the power to resist. They might have attempted, but they didn't ultimately have power to stop it. There were maybe cases of individuals helping individuals, but on a bigger scale, the violence wasn't stopped. And as I already mentioned, in Gorski Kotar, barricades were removed early on. So that's one condition that was important. And because of that, the communication was open. So for example, there was a case of, and this is a small example that just illustrates how in that particular region, there was concern for each other and across villages. So in Serb village, there was a wedding and they traditionally use there are gunshots at weddings in Serbian villages traditionally, and they warned neighboring Croat villages that this is why there would be gunshots. They would hear gunshots because of the wedding, and nobody's planning any attack. And the local police was informed, and they informed the local population, so everybody knew what was happening. And so that just shows you, and this was during the war, it just shows you that there are different ways that different regions were able to prevent, the divisions among the population. So that's basically my response, is that this production of borders or barricades were essential in the areas where violence could or could not escalate, and also the individuals who tried to moderate or negotiate were not disempowered in some parts. So those are the two main conditions.
To extend a bit, you just talked about solidarity and people helping one another as well. And so throughout the book, the focus is mostly on understanding sort of the structural conditions that are enabling collective crimes to take place, as opposed to a different approach that would judge individuals for their actions. So judge individuals for being bystanders or for turning away when violence is inflicted on others. But you do document these moments of solidarity, as you mentioned, where there's individual people who are risking everything to help their neighbors in a context that's very not conducive to interethnic cooperation or care. So what I'm curious about is, can you talk more about how these kinds of stories layer into the concept of amoral communities? Mm-hmm. To what extent is it a totalizing concept, like a community is amoral or it isn't? Were these discrete forms of solidarity or resistance often taking place below the surface, or are these stories so touching precisely because they are so rare?
Mm-hmm. Well, I as I mentioned already in the previous response, I don't believe that they are so rare. Basically, based on my interviews, they were very commonly mentioned by respondents across different regions. People were interconnected, and so that would not be the reason that they are, that I would say that in order to understand how these acts of solidarity fit in amoral communities, we would really have to look at. I think it's essential to look at these structural conditions, because just by themselves, the acts of solidarity cannot be power. They cannot have all the power to prevent the escalation or the descent into this amoral community. So it's really important to look at what help these individuals may get from either institutions locally or nationally to act, and what kind of support they can get either by their own community or, somehow they need a little more force in order to be able, or at least not to be stopped, by fear or threats and so on. So it's really important to consider, and this is actually what provides a little bit of hope, and in a way that violence can be prevented, is that we are aware that in almost all regions there are those who would want, there are these acts of solidarity, of human connection, that really are important, and they just need to be brought to the foreground by other factors. And why call these structural conditions? And I talk about ability to freely express your views, even if they don't align with one of the dominant sides, and then to preserve this freedom of movement of people so they don't feel trapped and afraid to act, on the basis of their views, of their own personal views. So that would be what I would say.
So as we were talking about a little bit before we hit record, I was saying to you how I love that this is a political science book that is based on ethnographic fieldwork and interviews, which isn't really the norm in political science. And so you draw on other disciplines, you draw on anthropology a lot in your book. Can you talk a bit methodologically about why this approach was so important for the book and what you gained or maybe lost by talking to people who have lived through the war and treating them as experts on their own lives?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's really something that first of all, when I started researching for this book and I talked to people, I encountered disconnects between what political leaders said and what perspectives people I talked to had about what happened, and that led me to question, you know, our maybe more standard methods in political science, and also to think that this method of interviews would provide new understanding of the conditions and also the situation on the ground, social, political context. Let me begin with what is lost maybe with this approach. It cannot be used to reconstruct historical accounts or to construct general causal arguments. It is also an approach that is based on in-depth interviews. So there is a relatively small number of respondents, and that makes generalization more challenging, of course. But what is gained was much more, for me, valuable for this. That's why I chose this method as the primary method. First of all, people with firsthand experiences are really experts, true experts. And so that is why I, in this book, treat them as teachers. They experience wars in their own lives. And so their accounts add certain depth and emotion. They actually add more objectivity than we often think. When we think of interviews, we think, oh, this is just an opinion of one person or another, but they add this authenticity of what happened in their lives. And so they also add diversity of perspectives. I was very intentional about trying to gather as diverse of a sample of respondents as I possibly could, and then draw some and try to identify some patterns. I should also mention that this is a very difficult book, difficult for both for participants, first of all, for respondents, but also for my research assistants, for myself. And it is difficult for readers as well. But it was because of all the subtlety and all the introspection of the work that that somehow I feel that it merited this difficult project, because there is some hope that maybe this can be prevented if we learn from those who have firsthand experience. So this is why I thought this method is particularly valuable for this kind of research.
I think your approach of treating people as experts is really is really great in the book. And you talk about how in certain cases, even though while the events were taking place, you know, 25 years ago, maybe they were gripped with fear or they at the moment couldn't analyze their decisions as they were making them, but they've also had decades to reflect on their own lives and to gain a critical insight and a critical distance even from certain events in their lives. And I just love that instead of the language of talking about, oh, people's memories of the war and how do they remember the war, you talk about their knowledge of it and position yourself as a student learning mm-hmm. about their lives. I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, that was really for me very important, and also for the respondents and for people who participated, it was important to be able to say, just to say what they experienced and to actually be taken as for these statements to be taken as their own statements, rather than to be changed or put into some kind of a narrative that wouldn't necessarily reflect what they wanted to express in their own words, in their own way. So that's why I thought treating them as experts is actually very important, to give them the voices that, and it's really interesting because as we were talking about, this process of exclusion of moderates, you realize that many of the people that are talking in this book could be considered moderates, actually. And finally, we can actually hear them and hear what they have to say. So it's really important for that particular reason too, in terms of wanting to prevent something in the future, not only in the region that I examine or three regions that I examine, but maybe in scholars of other areas could recognize some things in this work and could maybe also apply some of this and see if it applies to some other contexts as well.
Yeah, it's written in such a way that I feel like it's really applicable across different field sites and different contexts. And the way you lay it out and the sort of patterns you identify, I think you can see them happening in lots of different cases. So I really highly recommend this book to anyone interested in violence against civilians in wartime. But as the final question, I would like to ask you, what are you working on next?
So the next work, of course, I have to say that I will take a little break because this has been quite exhausting work. But I already started reading and thinking and doing some field research on nonviolence as a form of resistance, which there's a lot of research on. But I was interested particularly in the context of Croatia, in examining the case of Croatian Spring, which was a movement or effort to reform the political and economic system in Croatia and former Yugoslavia between 1970 and 72. And I wanted to connect this theoretically with the movement, with the literature on contentious politics and nonviolent resistance in a way to try to understand what potential these types of collective actions can have. And it is a form of an extension of this work because it will focus more on the non-violence, or explaining more non-violence rather than explaining the absence of violence, right? So in a more intentional way.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Great. And well, again, thank it's you just so much beginning. Yes, first a well-due period of rest.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate getting to talk to you about this book, and I hope everyone will read it.
Well, thank you, Yelena, for having me on the show and for excellent questions. And thanks again for the interest in this work.
So that was Mila Dragojevic talking to us about her new book, which came out this year, 2019, from Cornell University Press. It's called Amoral Communities, Collective Crimes in Time of War. Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you.